The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bob gets mad to the point of going nowhere, which was the goal. Vint works on TCP, leading to BP for IP before there even was an I in TCP. Aizen turns the corner, starts to climb, and hits zero. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go!
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enlighten DC will be held June 11th at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. We will focus on information integrity and time to transparency in the world of increasing influence operations intended to disrupt Western civilization. For details, see the listing at thecybershow.co.
Now on to our first presenting company.
Hi, we have Lakshmishan Gajanan from the iZen.ai. So guys, tell us, what does iZen.ai do and what's it about?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Fred. iZen is a education technology and workforce development company. And we primarily focus on equitable workforce development with e-learning that can be delivered to people anywhere in the world, when and where needed, without the need for the internet and our computers.
Okay. All right. We've had you on the show before. We did an extensive discussion of the various things you do. So what has happened that has changed, say, in the last 6 months of your operation?
Yeah. So we completed a big project for the Department of Energy, which is focused on workforce development for rural small businesses and people with constraints. And we are currently working on a project from the Navy, Office of the Naval Research, in the area of cybersecurity to build the cybersecurity awareness for beginners throughout the country.
Okay, so those are a couple of projects, but you've done a lot more than that, right? So as I recall, last time we talked to you, you were, what's the right word for it? Burning cash, right?
Yeah.
So I understand that you are actually now cash flow positive. Is that correct?
That's true. We just turned positive in terms of net income as of 2023. And we have built a lot of traction for the hockey stick growth in 2024 and beyond.
So that's fantastic. There are some other accomplishments that you have. My understanding is, besides being a small business, you have all sorts of other federal stuff you've done. What other federal stuff have you done that makes you better qualified and more likely to make money for those of us that want to invest in you and those of us that have invested?
Yeah. So we recently got approved as a GSMS, General Services Administration schedule, which is basically an enabler for us to sell to various federal and state government agencies.
So the GSA is this fantastic deal where, at least for selling to the federal government, as I understand it, anybody in the federal government with money that wants to buy what you have can, I guess, click a button and send you money and they get what you have, right?
In some cases, but in some cases, it has a minimal RFP, kind of a minimal application process. It's not too extensive. So basically, it minimizes the effort to get business from government.
Yeah, so give me a sense of this. How long does it take to get listed in the GSA? And because you ended up actually hiring somebody to help you do this, right? I mean, this is not apparently a simple effort, right?
It's not at all, right? So Gajanan can talk about it. But basically, we have spent close to a year getting it, along with an external consultant. So it's not an easy process at all, to be sure.
Well, let's just walk through it. Gajan, just give us a list of, say, the top 50 things, however many there were. What kind of stuff do you have to do to get on the GSA schedule?
Oh, everything you can imagine, right? They ask you for all the financials, they ask for all your customers, the revenue, you name it, Fred.
Well, no, I don't name it. You name it. Tell me what else is on the list. You've named three things: financials, customers, revenue. What else?
Your internal procedures, quality control, you know, procedures, the references, everything. Basically, about 150 plus documents.
And, yeah, I'm sorry, 150 plus documents.
Yes.
So over a year, that's one document every other day for a whole year you had to produce.
Kind of. But many times they ask you for, you know, reproducing the document again with the latest data, right? For example, the everything started in 2023 beginning, right, almost. Then by the end of the year, they wanted more, you know, latest documents. That also.
So you have to refresh it all for them because they're not quick enough at getting to the end of it. So. That's so right. What kind of weird questions are in there? Stuff that you just wouldn't expect.
Oh, questions are like, you know, what NIST code, the NIST code you're familiar with, right?
NAICS, North American Industry Classification System.
But that's a national code for the product or service offering. Right. Yeah, of course they do. Yeah, that's for sure.
So we need to justify why we qualify for them, right? We need to give explanation as to what we offer and why we are qualified to offer those services, for example.
Okay, so it's some description that says why it is that you can do whatever you claim. Is that right?
Yeah, and also I wanted to say there, right? These codes, NAICS codes, they were defined decades ago. And to fit into those, you know, it's a task, right?
Yeah.
And then you have to prove that you have sold similar services before, and you have to produce some invoices and pricing, and you know, there are all kinds of things that they ask for, which is not commonsensical in many, you know, many ways. So
yeah, especially for a startup, right? You're a small business, you're relatively early,
right?
So that makes it much, much harder. Okay.
And they also ask for a discount percentage, for example, right? Discounts. They want certain fees. GSA wants to keep certain percentage of your sale. So they negotiate this part up to certain numbers, certain percentage, beyond that, certain other volume discount, all that. They negotiate that.
So you negotiate all the contract terms and all of the discounts. And of course, there's this huge contract thing that you have to sign for any federal government thing that has all sorts of fields that say you don't grow poison and you're not in the chemical processing business and you don't do nuclear stuff, right. Whatever the list of things are. Yeah. So because I filled out those forms before, they take forever. And yeah. and then all the forms, you fill out all the forms and then they just say yes, right, or no.
No, it's not that simple. Then they want us to go through SBA for certification. They did not directly approve us, right? They say you need to qualify through SBA COC, Lakshmesh, right?
All right, so small business registration. Okay, so in order to be qualified as a small business, you have to go through not just the regular SBA application, but something else, right?
Yeah.
See, because GSA, many, you know, I guess majority of the vendors are big businesses, you know, with deeper pockets. Because we are a small business with some impactful services that we can certainly offer, they wanted us to get some additional assurance from the SBA that, you know, these guys are certified to be on GSA because they have done so and so, they have delivered so many projects. And they are capable of delivering, right? They are capable of supporting
the
delivery.
On the schedule. You have to be demonstrably able to perform whatever they're going to ask you to do, which is not a ridiculous thing. That's pretty sensible. But most people talk about, you know, how easy it is to get these things with the government. It's not easy. It takes time, and you have to be pretty serious about it, right? And yeah, and you need a consultant to help you, apparently. So that's right. So we're going to take a little break here, and let's come back.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. On Monday, the global network of Hamas supporters held a protest to disrupt flows of capital worldwide to cause maximum economic impact. But that didn't really work. On Tuesday, the Enlightened Conference met in San Francisco and around the world to counter malicious influence operations like the event on Monday. But that hasn't exactly solved the problem yet. Today, the battle rages on, and that's breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. In this segment, we're going to talk to Bob Monroe. Bob has a long history of being a hacker of one form or another, always in a legitimate way, always doing things in order to get the job done, so to speak. And of course, after he got out of his previous career, he started to work with Hacker High School to develop lessons that real people could understand. So when it comes to teaching people about cybersecurity and issues related to it, Bob is really outstanding. Here's Bob. We're back with Bob, and he has chosen not to go into Delta Force because he doesn't want to end up as a hitman or a mercenary. Instead, he's going to become a pilot because it looks good, and there are jobs.
Yep.
So talk us through that.
So flight school, back then, I was going to be a warrant officer. So in Army Aviation Flight School, back then, you were a warrant officer candidate for an entire year. So you're pretty much, you have the same rank as an E5, but you don't have much authority. You don't have, you're basically going to school with a whole bunch of other pilots. So there's no, it's a year of training is what it is.
But you're like a master sergeant, but a trainee.
No, you're not even a master sergeant. You're the guy that's mopping up the floors.
No, but I thought your rank is still sergeant, right?
It is, but you don't have, you're paid as a sergeant while you're going through flight school.
But nobody's working under you. You don't have any privates.
Yeah, but you're working for a whole lot of other people. You need somebody to buff the floor, call Walk Monroe. Hey, you need somebody to take out the trash, Walk Monroe. Bring them out here.
There you go. All right. But you also learned to fly, right?
Yeah. And a funny story about flying. The helicopter that I flew was the UH-1 Huey, the one you see in all the Vietnam movies.
Yeah, that's the big one with lots of people in it. It carries cargo and it carries the people being deployed into the field and such, right?
This one's a smaller one. If I had a picture, I'd show you, but it's radio, so I won't do any good.
That won't help much, right?
Yeah, it was the UH-1, like I said, the one you see in all the Vietnam movies.
With the people on board that jump off in the landing zone and then they get back on and they take out wounded and such. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, that aircraft. Well, anyways, when you're going through flight school, when you start to learn to fly, you have to show proficiency in certain tasks at a certain amount of training hours. For example, at the 10-hour point, you're supposed to be able to hover the Huey. Well, I was, of course, ADHD, and I'm over-controlling the aircraft. So I bring it up to a hover, and the aircraft just doesn't want to do what I want it to do, and I'm basically fighting the helicopter the entire time. And so I'm about the 7.5-hour mark, and I can't get the aircraft to hover. I can do some other maneuvers, but I can't get it to hover. So they call in a guest instructor. The instructors I had were usually civilian instructors, but this guest instructor was this captain. I'm like, oh, great. Got a captain going to teach me how to fly. Great. So we get in the aircraft and we're strapping in, get the aircraft started up. And he looks over and he sees I got a Ranger tab. He goes, oh, Ranger, huh? And he starts talking about this incident that happened about a year before where a Ranger was killed in a helicopter mishap. And he starts explaining why it's the Ranger's fault. I'm like, no. Sir, it wasn't his fault. In fact, he fell 70 feet to his death. And he's telling me that, no, it was the Ranger's fault because he was rappelling from a helicopter and it was the Ranger's fault. And I'm starting to get upset at this guy. And he's just chiding me on, going, you know, this is just the way it is. I'm like, sir, no, I know it. We all know the story. This is blasphemy, what you're saying. I'm getting to the point where I'm going to punch this guy. I'm in the aircraft, and I'm about ready to freaking knock this guy's teeth in. And he goes, stop. He goes, look outside. Look down on the ground. Haven't moved an inch. Aircraft, steady state. And he goes, see? He goes, I got your mind off of thinking of flying. The aircraft will do what you think you want it to do without you thinking you need to do it. I'm like, oh, that's a great lesson right there.
Yeah, you still wanted to punch him, but on the other hand, you wanted to hug him too.
Yeah, I want to hug him at the same time. Like, man, that's great. Then that's exactly the way a helicopter works. You just think, this is what I want it to do. You know, it's not as simple as that, but that's pretty much your body knows what movements need to be made, these micro movements that need to be inputted into the aircraft controls. So if you're used to like video games where you're banking left and banking right and do all this other stuff, well, you'll make a pretty lousy pilot. So I went graduating flight school and did a couple of assignments, wound up doing, I think, 22 years total. But somewhere, I think it was about the middle of flight school, I started thinking, well, what happens if I get injured? What happens if the Army doesn't need me anymore, doesn't want me anymore? I need something to fall back on. Or maybe I can't be an aviator. I may become permanently grounded. So I started getting into hacking. Now, back then, hacking was a good term.
Oh, hang on. It still is. We're going to take a break here.
Hey, Bob, you've been hacking all your life, just to be
yes,
clear.
Yeah. Yes, he has. <It's>,
you just found out.
Right. Yeah, and it is a good thing.
It is a good thing. It's a wonderful thing.
So I love the key performance indicator of proficiency versus time. You have so much time, you need to be able to do this thing. If you can't do this thing in that time frame, you should not be a pilot. And if you can, you can keep going.
Right.
It's such a crisp and defined thing. When I think about how people learn and how I try to teach them about cyber-related things, there's almost nothing that's ever that crisp and clear.
Well, and this is, honestly, I think one of the things I love about conflict, right? You know, whether it's, you know, classic conflict or, you know, just the conflict inside a working group. You know, when you get a group of people together, you're trying to have a conversation, you're trying to advance an issue, right? You know, it clarifies things. It's, you know, you've got an hour right here and we got, you know, 5 or 40 people on this call, and you want to get, you know, things moved along over the next 3 weeks. You meet once a week, right? You know, you have to push. And it's, yeah, I think, you know, speaking for the ADHD crowd, I think, you know, there's something wonderful about, you know, making it simple. You know, to your point, you can or you can't. In this time, here you go. Move on.
Well, another part of it is the difference between what you're trying to do and paying attention to and what you're able to do naturally just because you are who you are and you understand that, right? People are these cybernetic systems, right? We're complex feedback systems. And we feel our way through things. You know, when you drive a car, all the logic and reasoning you want won't help you. But when you're holding the wheel and feeling the back pressure, you can recognize it. And then you get in a car that's no longer mechanically connected to the wheels, and they try to simulate that. And probably I end up in traffic accidents.
Right. You know, yeah. I started my full-time working career, you know, in a warehouse, in a printing plant, right? And I had a forklift with opposing forks. And I would pick up two bales, massive bales of paper at a time, and haul them around, load trucks and so forth. And got to the point where any good forklift operator knows you can do the things like drop a quarter on the floor and flip it up onto your forks. It just becomes natural, right? And yeah, so that's that cycle of being forced through it. In Bob's case, in a military context, and now he's getting into hacking and cybernetics and so forth. It's a I'll get downright hippie. It's what gives meaning and context to life, right? In an infinite universe with finite time and resources and so forth. Why? Because we figure things out.
Because our bodies figure things out. Our brain is part of our body. And the combination of our physicality and the mechanisms of feedback and control in our brain adapt to the world, so clearly. It's all the rationale and all the thinking through of things. It's almost a different world than the physical reality. And, our ability to deal with the physical world is so different. What we imagine is the case, what we think through, what we analyze is so different from that I'm going for a walk and I know how to do that. Right.
Well, and not all of us get to, fly things or drive boats, as I'm going to go in a second, but almost everybody learns how to drive. And you remember that when you were learning how to drive and you're actually turning the steering wheel and so forth. And after a couple of decades, you're not turning the steering wheel anymore. Right. Yeah. You're just moving the vehicle, right? You don't think about the actions and the difference in that. And I'll tell you, the last 2 years, building and sailing these crazy boats, has been such a great analogy for all of these things. Brian Ford, shout out to Brian Ford, friend from Cisco, the late 90s and so forth, came out of the boats, picked him up at the dock, at the boat ramps, at a park. And you folks had to picture this. I have two 24-foot long pontoon boats, one 8-foot wide and one 10-foot wide, tied together with nothing but solar power and electric motors and so forth. And I drive them as a unit. So I spin this thing around and bring one of them up to the dock, and it's low tide in this shallow little spot, and it's crosswind, so I have to spin back around and get stuck a little bit. It's the meaning of life, right? I'll get all snoopy on you because what else is there, right? Fred and I here, we've been around the world and done all sorts of great things, been dined with kings and queens, and it's lovely. It really is, right? It's the journey. Figuring things out along the way. Bob is, I love the Bob stories, right? Because the classic hacker story, right? Self-made person who said, all right, I'm going to do these things and shove themselves into a situation after situation just to see what happened. Why not? What else are you going to do?
Okay. And then we have lessons from Bob. I love the lesson of he's now, an E5, whatever that is, right? Because all the ranks aren't, whatever we used to think of them when we watched the World War II movies. He's an E5. He's a specialist or whatever. But his rank is essentially a sergeant. But if you look at the hierarchy he is in, it's a relative world. He's the bottom of the totem pole, right? So, and no matter where you go, no matter how high you get, there's always somebody above you. I mean, I'm sure the president of the United States, who is married, is responsible Congress. To his wife. It's like, sorry. Yeah, Congress and all that stuff. But his wife, he's probably, sorry, Hey, John.
Well, as any CEO will tell you, we're shareholders. Right? Yeah, you're the boss. Yeah, guess what?
Yeah, right. I'm the boss, right. I'm the boss who can get fired or hired based on your performance over which you think I have no control, which is... Okay, this gets more, difficult and complicated. So one of the things I just love about Bob is everything he says, everything he talks about it's so simple. His manner of communication is so simple and so direct that it's just so easy to understand, and it's all a lesson in life. It's like... I've been struggling lately with my inability to communicate effectively, despite my capacity to use voluminous words to express, complex concepts.
Well, it's Stuart Phillips, right? We both know, right? And he's somebody I've known for 30 years, and we talk all the time, almost as much as I talk with you. And, it's like a fine wine, friendships, and you find out what you learn about yourself. right? And I am really, really good at certain things, you know, and I can come up with something and talk about it and explain it in great detail and take 30 minutes. Stu can repeat it back to me in a sentence. I don't know how he does that. But once you hear the sentence, you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's the
information. Yeah, that's what I meant. It's not what I said, but it's what I meant.
That's actually that. Well, that's the sentence we need to use if we want this to happen. Right, because by the time I finish explaining my great idea to anyone who could actually do anything about it, they're probably going to forget. Right, you know. So we have these different ways. Yeah, like these, you know, folks like Bob. Like I don't think I know Bob, and I want to hang out with him because, yeah,
he's
a good team. Right.
Excellent. The other thing that this brings up in my mind is yesterday. We were on a conversation with Wynn Schwartow in that group, and he wants us to give him approaches and expressions to talk about the things in the influence and counter-influence operation space. And he wants, you know, less than 100 words, you know, very simple. So I end up writing a couple of, you know, short poems, you know, like 3 words per line, no more than 3 lines. I don't know whether that's something he wanted or not, or whether it has any meaning for anybody other than me, but I thought it was fun enough to do. So this morning, I'm on a call with Carolyn, my daughter, who's also working on the website for Enlighten, which is a conference company that we have. And you know, the tagline is Enlighten, you're way ahead. And she wants another tagline under that tagline. I'm like, why do you want a tagline under a tagline? And she explains it to me, and I say, okay. And I don't like the tagline that's there. So it's at the end of the call, and she's really pushing me on it. So I come up with, all right, how about this? Events that inspire and inform. I think that's right. I don't know. That might be what I, something like that. And so, you know, I think she's going to put that on the website. That's a good one, right? That's better than what we had before. This whole thing of coming up with these short expressions that convey something that's deeper in what you're trying to communicate, but are short enough to work so people can think about it, remember it, get it in their brain, and interpret it in their way so that they adopt it for themselves. And at the same time, it's done in a manner that it expresses the concept you want. I think, you know, I should have been in advertising. You forget all this other crap. Or is my stuff just terrible? That's my question for you.
Well, it's what we were talking about before I started doing this reporting, right? You know, there's writing books and there's doing journalism, right? In the traditional historical model. And what we have, you know, since, you know, 2008, we won't go there, you know, on this clip, but, social media and influence campaigns and so forth, same thing, different scale and whatnot, you know, look, you know, breaking down the components is journalism more than writing books. You know, writing books, you know, writing a book is a monolithic project that has a single result. And if you write 3, that's quite a lot. And then you have 3 samples out there. Journalism, you know, again, even old school journalism, you're writing articles all the time, every day, every week and so forth. They may not last forever, but you get a lot of practice, a lot of experience, a lot of feedback, a lot of metrics. And obviously in the current world, social media, you know, it's, you know, there can be the right memes and quips and so forth, but it's really not about that. You know, it's, you know, I'll give Elon Musk of all people a kudo here. You know, at least I'll give the Starship crowd, the SpaceX crowd, iterate, do it over and over and over again. Right. And that's what, you know, in the cognitive world, you know, in active competition and cognitive spaces, you have to have that process, right? You have to be journalists, not authors, right?
It's not a matter of figuring it all out and perfecting it and then expressing it. It's a matter of being able to act in the moment on an ongoing basis and take your shots, and, you know, you win some, you lose some, right?
Get metrics, figure out what works. You know, you may have, you know, there are unicorn individuals and there's unicorn, you know, artifacts in the kinetic and in the mimetic world. You know, maybe this is a wonderful thing. However, you know, mostly, well, it's like the Sherman tank in World War II. Best tank in the war? Nope. But there were a lot of them. And they got really, really good after failing a lot, you know.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Vint Cerf is one of the best known early internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
We're back with Vint. And so now we're starting to talk about the host level software for the ARPANET, right? So the ARPANET has these IMPs, the message switching mechanisms, that allowed you to move messages from place to place. But connected to those were always hosts, right? Because the hosts are where the storage and the execution is performed. The IMPs are just for communications. So talk to us about what was necessary in those hosts to have this thing function.
Well, first of all, it's important to recognize that the packet switches, the IMPs, were not message switches. They were packet switches. And that's important because the Defense Department already had the Defense Information Network, AutoDIN, and that was message switching. This packet switching took whatever chunk of data that the host had and chopped it up into 1,000-bit pieces, blasted them across the network. They were adaptively, alternately routed, reassembled at the destination IMP, and then handed to the host. Now, you use the word message, and that is technically correct because they called those messages and they were broken up into packets.
Yeah, well, so that's right. Even in DISN and these places, it didn't do complete message. You would break messages up into smaller messages. But actually, you know, if you're going to talk about packet switching, really the ARPANET ran on, as I recall, datagrams.
That's not quite correct. What happens is that the IMPs received what was called a message from the host, could be up to 8,000 bits long. It would then have an exchange with the destination IMP to make sure there was room to assemble the message that was being about to be broken up to eight different packets. And so there was an exchange between the source and destination before anything got sent. The first message that goes to the destination actually contains one packet's worth of data. So if you had a one packet message, it just went there. If you had a multi-packet message, there was an exchange to make sure it could be reassembled at the destination. So there was a lot of work going on to keep everything in order and also to make sure that there was not going to be reassembly lockup at the destination.
Yeah, now this is before UDP and TCP, you know, that's UDP being one.
Right.
Yeah. So this is even at a lower level than at the what we think about as the current network level.
Well, yes. The underlying network does a whole lot of work to keep things in order and everything else in the ARPANET. The hosts had to have a way of initiating a connection and ending a connection, making sure that everything got to the destination. But it didn't. We didn't have two three-way handshakes. We didn't have confirmations end-to-end because the assumption was that the underlying network would deliver everything in order and reliably. And that's what, you know, BBNN was promising. So those weren't, they were messages, but we didn't call them datagrams. The datagram shows up in the internet. That language shows up in the internet environment primarily.
So the internet protocol first defined datagrams. Is that right? So at the ARPANET
because the first protocol that gets designed for the internet was called the Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP. And that is treated as a stream of bytes of off.
Yeah, but TCP runs over IP. So you're saying that TCP was defined before IP?
TCP was defined in 1973. And the first paper was written and published in IEEE Transactions on Communications in May of 74. So we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of that classic paper. Then several iterations later of TCP, and the third iteration, we break out the internet protocol. And we do that because TCP was designed to deliver everything in sequence and reliably with handshakes and, you know, reassemblies and all this stuff. Yeah. But that didn't handle real-time communication very well, because if you drop something and we knew it, we'd retransmit it. But when you retransmit something, you introduce delay. If you introduce delay, real-time processing gets messed up. especially packet voice, packet video, and maybe, you know, radar tracking and all this other stuff. So for those applications where it didn't matter if everything was delivered, but it did matter that it got delivered quickly and in order. Not necessarily in order. It did not reorder anything. It would just deliver whatever, you know, showed up.
Yeah, you could add ordering, you know, sequence numbers to the interior information if you needed it.
Well, TCP is the one that handled all the reliability.
No, but that forces it, right? TCP forces sequential behavior at the endpoints, but UDP and other. So how about ICMP? Was that before TCP and those things?
No, ICMP was part of the specification of the original TCP protocol because we had to say something about what went wrong.
All right, now we have to fix ICMP, Internet Control Message Protocol.
Right.
Right. TCP, Transmission Control Protocol. And you didn't mention UDP, which is User Datagram Protocol,
correct,
and IP, which is Internet Protocol. All
right. Right.
So, and by the way, when you got to IP, was this IPv1 or 2? Or because no, 4 came later, right?
The first split comes with the third iteration of TCP. So really IPv3 is the first one. To try to be aligned with
because, you know, why wouldn't you start at 3, right?
Right. Well, except that we wanted it to be aligned with the version of TCP. And then TCP version 4 and IP version 4 are aligned. And so the thing which is still widely in use right now is TCP version 4 and IP version 4. However, we've since introduced IP version 6 with a larger address space, and I wish more people would implement it so we could get out of the crunch that we're in right now with V4.
No, we'll stay in V4 probably forever. You know, railroad ties are still the same distance apart as they were in Rome.
Well, I can tell you that even though it has been disappointing, we do have more IPv6 running, and the mobiles, for the most part, are all running V6, and the interplanetary protocols, which we haven't talked about yet, I would also arguing that if we use IP at all for the interplanetary stuff, which we don't have to do, I want to run it over V6, not over V4. Yeah.
Well, but just think the initials, you know, interplanetary IP, right?
Well, I suppose you could pull that off, except we have a new protocol called Bundle Protocol, which does the interplanetary stuff to keep it from being confused with TCP/IP, which we don't want to use on an interplanetary basis.
Yeah, well, especially because you have to wait for returns. But all right, so we're gonna take a break here.
Okay.
Let's do. You know, I just want to be clear because, you know, when I listened to it played back, you know, he was talking about messages going to packets, because what we had before was message switching. And we moved to packet switching. And then when I talked about datagrams versus packets, he said, no, packets were assembled into messages. So the packet switching was actually message switching. So, you know, all of these, what is the word, a distinction without a difference? They are different. In fact, at a technical level, they're extremely important differentiated concepts. But for anybody listening to the show, this is how it is. If you talk to a medical doctor, right, the medical doctor is going to talk about different conditions that seem to you to be indifferentiable, right? Because, like, my knee hurts. Well, what is it? Well, it could be this or this or this or this. Yeah, but my knee hurts, right? And I think that's a good way to think about this. I also love that it started on version 3.
Right.
Right.
And yeah, the first one is in version 1 because you're not thinking versions. You're just saying a thing.
Well, no, because TCP, he explained it. Transmission Control Protocol did have a version 1 and a version 2, and they weren't really what they wanted. When they went to version 3 for TCP, that's when they decided to split out IP and ICMP and all these other things.
Right.
And so they didn't want the versions to be different. Now, I just want to note that that's really not true in a lot of other stuff, right? We see lots of times when people didn't do that. So you have, you know, version 7 of this with version 2.3 of this and 6.8 of that and all these, you know, you look at the SBOM descriptions, the software bill of materials descriptions, and you'll find all these different version numbers coming together and subversions. And then patching is creating sub-sub-subversions. And by the time you get through all this process, there are a very large number of combinations of things that may or may not successfully go together that creates another one of those holes, you know, where this is slightly incompatible with that. So how does SBOM and those things, how do they deal with all those complex minor versions with date and time that are, you know, just this patch came 3 minutes after that one and so forth?
Well, yeah, that's a good question because, you know, my focus in the DHS or the CISA, and acronyms, Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, anyway, working groups, has been on the sharing of supply chain intelligence, sharing of SBOMs. And one of the fascinating parts of this whole exercise, you know, for me will always be how difficult it's been. You know, as this is 60 months, you know, it's sort of 5 years of working with groups to get the conversation to the point where you can avoid, you know, where you can focus on something, right? Because in the SBOM space, yeah, exactly. You know, the data inside an SBOM, you know, hold my coffee. Oh my God, version numbers, country of origin. What's that really mean? Who defined that? You know, there's kind of every issue you want, you know, inside that. And just focusing on sharing, right? You know, and if I create an SBOM, whoever I am, and maybe I'm not the software vendor, right? Because there's been software vendors involved in these conversations to date. So the conversation has been, you know, an SBOM comes from whoever made the software, and it should, and it perhaps usually will, and so forth. But when you're just focusing on sharing, just that, you know, let's just define who the entity is that made this bloody thing, because they have certain interests, certain roles, and things to consider when they're going about sharing that thing. And, you know, if I'm not the one who made it, but somebody has asked me to share it, now I've got a different role and different considerations. And if I'm, you know, the one who's consuming it, I want it, you know, I have other considerations, you know, how I get it, you know, the discovery, access, transport, or, you know, whatever taxonomy we want to put on that. And that's, you know, when we see those artifacts, you know, throughout, right? When I came along, TCP/IP existed, right? You know, I had a UUCP connection, my first internet connection, then we got a, you know, IP and got into all that stuff. And literally, you know, gophering around and figuring out how this works. You know, the UD, you know, all the acronyms you're throwing around. I almost remember the days that I learned those, right? You know, something would come up and I have to look it up, and I'd like, go to a whiteboard and I draw out a datagram. It's got this field followed by that field. Why? I didn't know. But it just is. And it is, as we find out, you know, in conversation, you know, listening to people like Vint and so forth, those things are because of other working groups, where, you know, 4 to 12 people, you know, were faced with an issue and they came up with a way to deal with it in taxonomy. So, you know, the words like packet and message mean certain things because those conversations, they meant certain things. And we can look at the parallels between packet switched everything in the electronic world and the containerized shipping system that is developed in parallel at the same time, and the similarities between all that. And the fact that we use the word packet in our heads, you know, forms a certain mental picture, right? You know, and that picture informs the way we think about and the kinds of solutions we come up with. So it's just, and I know I say this all the bloody time, but I can't ever get over it. You know, the layers and layers and layers of intention, you know, people came together, did a thing. Other people came, you know, 7 generations away, you know, it's, well, this is the way it's done. Which is quite often really a good and wonderful thing. But again, that's always an opportunity. Just because it's been done this way, you go back to the root. Why was it done that way? Oh, that actually doesn't apply anymore. You know, and then flip the paradigm and do things entirely differently.
So there are some things that I think are sort of these wonders of the world. One of them is the naming, the cleverness of naming. So the interface message processor, the IMP.
IMP. Love it. Always love the IMP.
Yeah, I have to wonder how many hours they spent on thinking about different names for that thing, deciding to call it the IMP, and the emotions and the thought processes going around their heads of this IMP, this impish creature that was going to carry out all of that communications, right? It's like, send it to the IMP, and in their mind, they must have had a picture in their mind of the IMP that they're sending it to, right?
Well, and demons, you know, system demons, yeah. Right? Yeah, that's literally right from that. You know, that's this little guy that just sits there doing a thing.
Right. So there's that. And then Another thing is, I probably shouldn't, but I probably will tell you another story about these versions. Okay. So these version issues are incredibly complicated, right? Especially when you get to the part where you're trying to do forensics. So I've had forensics cases where you're trying to reconstruct some situation from the past. And in this one particular case, this was one of the Enron cases. So this is somebody accused of a crime in the context of the whole Enron debacle. I think that's a good way to describe it. And the evidence is based on some file stamp, some time stamp on a file from years before. And in this particular case, it's worse than usual because all of the backups that were the basis for all this stuff were stored in the basement of the World Trade Center. Guess what happened to the World Trade Center between Enron and the time of the trial? Okay, so all of the backups for all these things are now gone. So now they're trying to reconstruct all this evidence by getting it from different places. So like when you send an email, that email goes through a series of servers. And that's part of that store and forward thing we were talking about with Vint before, and we'll be talking about it again later. So copies of that sit in various places throughout the network. And in those various copies, because you don't have the official backup and the originals are probably gone because they delete stuff over time or the company out of business, eventually, if you look hard enough, you can find some of these things as residual information in these servers, wherever they were. All of the servers, of course, when they receive it, they put their own timestamps on stuff. So they receive something and they put their timestamp on. So, okay, so now the question is, what does that timestamp look like? And the timestamps generally have not just the time, but they have the time zone. So depending on where it is, you look at the time zone, and the time zone might say it's in the middle of the ocean. Okay, so it's somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but it was stored in Virginia. Okay, well, excuse me, Virginia's not in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So you got those problems. Internally within the files, there are other timestamps. So the question in this particular case was, how much time did this individual actually have to look at this thing, see it with their eyes, look at it, think about it? Did they, in fact, have any time at all? Did they ever look at it? And so forth. Okay, so that's the underlying question. And you start to look through this evidence. And the question then is, well, what piece of software wrote it? Because different versions of different pieces of software do different things with this timestamps. They may have more digits. They may place it in different places or sequences in the file. They may do all sorts of weird things in the way they encode it. So we go to reconstruct it, and we know what version of Windows it's from. We know what version of Word it's using or whatever the stuff was. But then there are patches. So it turns out the patch information isn't usually stored in the internal formats. So now in order to figure out what happened, we went through probably 50 or 60 historical versions of patches for the operating system and the email server and the document, probably the Word or whatever was used to produce the document, and started trying combinations in sequence to figure out over the available time span which version it was that produced this. You go through that whole process, and it turns out the particular version that produced this had particular characteristics that were advantageous for the case. Now, I wish I could say that was the only time in history that that happened. However, there was another case I worked on having to do with floppy disks, where a person was being accused of something bad, and the accusation had to do with the fact that some piece of software was loaded that would allow them to do some nefarious activity. And in this case, we went through every historic version of that particular piece of software to figure out each of the functionalities that could or could not do the things that they were claiming. And we found out that the specific version we were able to identify didn't do the stuff they claimed that it was doing, and therefore that it could not have been done based on the evidence available. So somehow this mapping of functionality into versions and patches of all of the things present, everything that's in an S-bomb, becomes incredibly complicated and very difficult. And the ability to map that stuff together over time for forensics probably saves an enormous amount of effort, probably lets innocent people go free, probably puts guilty people in jail. So the importance of this stuff, you know, forget about all the cost savings and stuff. People end up in jail. People can end up, you know, going to the death chamber because of this stuff.
Yeah, that best question I got, my favorite question yesterday from the DHS talk on S-bomb sharing was about combining my thoughts about, or our thoughts about combining that information with other information, right? And I believe my answer was something like, yes, hold my coffee, right? You know, so we're just beginning in this space, and we're doing it for cybersecurity reasons, you know, because events have happened, we're reached a tipping point in time. You know, there's legislation, you know, government agencies requiring, and it's, you know, it's happening, right? So we're moving S-bombs around. Now what? But again, hold my coffee. Forensic work, you know, everything you just said, you know, operations, all sorts of things. What is the value of visibility? And that time to visibility, you know, again, everything you said, you know, tracking that down and being able to say what actually, you know, whatever what I'm concerned with right now, where is the information? What can I determine from it? Before I could even do the Columbo bit and say, all right, given this typewriter and this, you know, letter, then, you know, the keys match. So I can't get that visibility that I can't make the match in the first place. So,
well, you sort of can. It's just that it takes an enormous amount of time and effort to do it.
Well, and again, that right. It means it doesn't get done. It may as well be impossible, right? You know, it takes more budget than you have or more time that can logistically be done, then it's not an option.
Well, but if it's important enough, you can pay me and I'll spend the time and effort. It would probably be better for you if you could push a button and get the answer, but it's much better for me that you can't.
Well, but as an evolutionary force, though, it always, you know, we bend towards the energy source. We bend towards the sun. And
right. So I have made my career out of not doing that stuff once it was all figured out. Right. So at one point in digital forensics, I did disk capture. You know, you image a disk, so you get a copy of the bit-for-bit content on the disk somewhere else so you can do the examination process. When that became automated, you may recall from our discussions with Mark Menz, he was one of the first people to automate that and put hardware devices together to do that. Once that was automated, it became a plug the disk in and push the button. Well, at that point, I no longer did that part of the process. Because anybody can do it. It's inexpensive. It's easy to do. It doesn't require any thought. In fact, it's almost hard to do wrong once that's perfected. So I'm always trying to find the place where people don't know it yet, where they haven't figured it out, because I like living on that edge. Obviously, you are the same in that regard, right?
Yeah. Doodle in the margins, right? You know, yes, you have to do the work down the center of the page, but, you know, doodle in the margins. It's, again, it's not for everybody, right? And, you know, and again, we're all a matter of degree. You know, I am, you know, to many people surprised, much of a homebody.
Yeah, you're a homebody in the ship of your own construction.
Right. But we all have, we all have our comfort zones. And for those of us who really just get a thrill, right, you know, out of poking around the edges, finding the unbit, you know, all this stuff. You know, I always think of it's like finding there's a spot on the floor you can bounce and the door opens, right? You know, that's just delicious, right? It's just, you know, and then you can go around and say, look at the beams and figure out why it is that way. But, you know, so much of it is just phenomenal, you know, phenomenon is the phenomenon itself, right? You know, it's we observe things and go, huh. You know, that little, I don't know even what it was, but the crack between the door and the frame, I just noticed out of the corner of my eye, I move. Every time I walk by this spot, so we slow down the next time, and you go, bump. And you're staring up in the corner, it's like, oh, it moved. You know, what is that? Oh, there's a lock there. Yeah. I wonder if it moves enough to pop the lock. It does.
And it is the figuring out, not just that it happens, noticing it, and then that analytical process of trying to get to the causality. And then being able to invoke the cause to produce the effect, right? That is it, right?
That's a hallelujah. Okay, watch this, and then you know, and we're all bad this way in our own, you know, endearing ways, right? You know, we will set people up for it. It's like, just walk through the kitchen, you know, get somebody to walk into the room. And we were thinking about it for the last hour and a half, right? And just get there and we notice their eyes moving a certain way and we jump on that spot and the door opens, right? And they're, what was that? It's like, let me tell you.
And in many ways, it's like a really good joke. You figured out a really clever response, but you now have to drive somebody to ask the question for which you can give that response.
Exactly. That probably sums up so much of this industry and so much of all of our careers. You know, we're all just trying to find those opportunities, set them up so we can say, see, there's this thing right there. Yeah.
So I'll just one example before we end this particular session. It was in the last, you know, 8 or so years, I was trying to understand and characterize the words to use to describe a political situation. And all of a sudden I noticed, wait a minute, they're trying to disestablish something. Oh, wait, there are people trying to stop them. And I found a place where I could use anti-disestablishmentarianist, not ism, ist,
yes,
which is the same length. It's, you know, the longest word in the English language, except supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which is a made up word, but it's so is anti-disestablishmentarianism. So I finally got to use it in an actual sentence. And that's the kind of thing that makes it fun. And I'm just going to give you one other game to play. So this was during the pandemic, my son and his wife were here and they were waiting to have their baby. And I was here with Susan, my wife, and we started to play the word game. So the idea here is you start with a sentence. It has to be a complete sentence that's meaningful. That's a one word with one syllable. Ah, yes. Okay, easy enough. The next player has to come up with a two-word sentence, complete meaningful sentence, that has two words, each with two syllables. Very tricky.
Very tricky.
All right. So now the next one says, okay, three words with three syllables each. Okay, well, you can probably come up with one of those before too long. Then you go to four words with four syllables each. Then five with five. We got up to seven words with seven syllables each. And we were able to do that. It took a little while. But, you know, that exponential combination of the two dimensions, you know, that's a fun little puzzle game for those people that like to do that stuff. So I would just want to invite all of our listeners to email into the show your sequence of a complete sentence that's meaningful, consisting of N words, each word with N syllables, for increasing values of N. And so send it into the show and, you know, provide your name and information. And the longest one we come up with, I will announce on the show. I will put your name on the show along with your sentence, and we will give you full credit. And after we do that for the first person who gets, what, to eight words with eight syllables per word, then we're going to be looking for the next one. We'll give even more credit to the person that comes up with a nine-word sentence with nine syllables per word. What do you think?
And a coffee mug.
Oh, no. So for a coffee mug, you got to do better than nine, don't you think?
No, I think mugs are great. Shotskis, like all the other, you know, the intellectual artifacts that we're always talking about. You know, I love the little physical artifacts. I love seeing other people's too, right? You know, the
All right. So nine syllables, nine words, a complete meaningful sentence in English. Obviously, in German, you could do 35 words of 35 syllables each without even thinking about it, probably. But in English, and you will get an Agatera mug. What do you think? Oh, and an
Agatera mug. I will get an Agatera mug, absolutely.
Yep, and a Fred Cohen pen.
There you go.
There you go. You'll have to provide your right address.
Go teams.
And we will pay the postage anywhere in the United States or Europe. Well, anywhere except the countries where we're not allowed to have stuff. Well, not North Korea. Not, you know, wherever it's not barred.
Yay.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Listen, starting today, Cyber Show's rewarding contestants participate strenuously in gendering elevation. Hopefully by now you get the idea. Produce a sequence of legitimate, meaningful English sentences with N words of N syllables each, starting at 1 and reaching 9, and you can win an Augutera mug and a Fred Cohen pen, only on The Cyber Show. The first person to reach each level above 5 wins a prize. Sophisticated indoctrination methodology universally misidentifies. Radicalization, anticipatory, revisionalized. Next week on The Cyber Show, Aizen gets into room 8A, and that's the place to be. Bob gets his access denied, but can he hack it? Vint enters the internet era, or rather, he holds the door open so you can enter. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A strange beaten man, and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.